This episode of the TGFB podcast is presented by River. River's the best and most secure place to buy Bitcoin in the United States. You can head over to river.com/TGFB to set up an account today, and you'll be able to DCA into Bitcoin without paying any fees. The river.com/learn tab is one of the best places to find helpful learning materials and videos that help explain what Bitcoin is, how it works. They have a bunch of other features as well. You can give people Bitcoin via River links. You can be able to send and receive Bitcoin over the Lightning Network and be able to set limit orders. And if you want to buy Bitcoin or sell Bitcoin at a particular price, either above or below where it is now. There's also the ability to leave cash in your River account and earn 3.8% paid out in Bitcoin. Go to river.com/TGFB. Set up your account in minutes today. Go support those guys. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Thank God for Bitcoin podcast. My name is Jordan Bush. I'm the executive director of TGFB Media, and I'm joined today by my guest, Paul Miller. Paul, how are you doing?
Hello. I'm well. Thank you for having me.
I'm glad to hear it. Paul is one of our favorite guests. Paul has spoken at all three of the Thank God for Bitcoin conferences the last 3 years. And again, he's one of the most lauded speakers. We always get people talking about his talks. So we're grateful to have him here. Paul, why don't you introduce yourself and what you do for the people who might not be familiar with your work?
Yeah, I'm Paul. I don't know what to call me. I'm a front-end developer. I work for a company called Mutiny. We used to make a Bitcoin wallet, and we have pivoted, and we are working on this new project called Open Secret, and a part of that project is another thing called Maple. So we're making a platform for developers to make like privacy focused apps, kind of the tool set that we wish we had when we were making Mutiny. So it's not a specifically a Bitcoin product, but it would be very useful for someone making a Bitcoin product or privacy focused. A lot of developers just end up with so much user information they don't actually want it, and it's a liability. So it's Open Secret, and the other thing is Try Maple, which is a private AI chat that we're using as kind of like a testbed of our Open Secret tech. So if anyone wants to check those out, so that's been fun. It's been a very different time. So now I'm a bit more of a pleb right now. Although we are wearing the Mutiny shirt lives on. Turns out the Mutiny shirt was much higher quality than the wallet that it is named after. We've been winding down the wallet, and in my distant past, I was a tech journalist, and I'm a lifelong Christian. I'm currently a Presbyterian.
Hey,
which I don't think I would. When we first met, I don't think that wasn't the case yet.
It wasn't the case for me either, and yet here we are. Presbyterians? Yeah. So we're both Presbyterians. We're both wearing Mutiny shirts. We're both wearing the same headphones. Shout out to Sony.
Twins. I need to re-up my sit-by.
Kid, I have a recommendation for you. I found these like incredible little ear covers for these. They're like velour. They're amazing. Paul, we are super grateful for your work. Paul is one of these people who I look up to most in the Bitcoin space. Again, the tech space in general is not known for it's having tons of Christians, especially vocal Christians. And ever since the day I met you and we talked for the first time on your podcast, you were just super, out front and open about your faith. And so we talked openly about, again, Bible verses and interpreting different passages right from the beginning. So Paul's always one of my favorite people to hang out with and talk with, one of the most thoughtful people I know. So Paul, you're here. You've been on the podcast before. You went to war with our good friend Eric Kaysen about God versus Bitcoin and what should be our relationship to Bitcoin and some of the ways that tempts us to, some of the ways Bitcoin and money more broadly tempts us to go wrong and how we look at it and think about it and how our hearts, treat it. So I guess what I want to do, Paul, I just want to kind of hear, what you've been working on Mutiny. Obviously that, didn't go the way you guys were anticipating, but you're working on Open Secret privacy. In addition to Bitcoin, if in the last 5 years, I would say the two things that I've thought more about and that have interested me more than just about anything have been Bitcoin and then privacy related things. We've got, both of us have, I think both of us have friends who either work for or have worked for, something like the embassy. It's the Start 9. You know, we have friends who have worked for there. And just, I really appreciate what they're doing. And especially thinking about it from, as a Christian, thinking about applying those tools in like a mission context, you know, if there's churches or, Christians who are ministering in places where it's illegal to be a Christian or it's illegal to own a Bible. I love the fact that there's companies creating tools that can be leveraged by those people to continue to allow them to make disciples around the world. So, you know, let me just ask you, what was it about privacy technology that, you know, you thought made it a worthwhile thing to do after, you know, this pivot with Mutiny?
I'm actually not naturally a privacy person. It's like not my, it's not my thing. Like I'm obsessed with it's, I just end up friends with really privacy obsessed people. So Matt Odell and Tony Giorgio.
Yep.
And
shout out to Matt, shout out to Tony.
Yeah. And so, I've literally actually sat there. Tony, tell me why you care so much about privacy. And I was just going to write this down and try to vibe it out. But I think there's really what motivates me is I struggle with the term self-sovereign as a Christian.
Yeah, right? I know. I get it too. I get you.
But there's a an aspect of a technology that you're personally, you have a personal responsibility for, and that personal responsibility is kind of what leads to your anti-fragility. Everybody who like bemoans like how Facebook's algorithm or, you know, Google spies on me, there are aspects of that are kind of unavoidable, and they're still the bad guy. But there's also aspects of where we just kind of give over our personal agency to the most convenient technology, and so that's it. So yeah, anyways, I'm very much into, yeah, can you provide somebody with some sort of stronger flag in the ground? I don't know. I'm kind of drifting off of the privacy thing here, but yeah, the big unlock with Open Secret is this, the cryptography world. There's a phrase I really like. Cryptography turns problems into key management problems.
Mm.
And so basically, you take something that's like, how do I secure my money, right? Now it's like, you know, it's not putting gold in a vault anymore.
Yeah.
It's keeping track of and secret 12 or 24 words, you know?
Yeah.
So it turned this problem of how do I store money that seemed like very multivariate and kind of crazy into a very specific, but still, it's still a thing.
Yeah.
And so the problem, and I kind of go back and forth on this, is that still to do cryptography, to do like self-custody, right, the user needs to, they not only need to write down like 12 or 24 words, they have to know why they're doing it.
Yeah.
Because if you don't know why you're doing it, then you don't know why or how to keep it secure or safe.
Correct. Yep.
And that level of education cuts across cuts counter to how we basically as a whole society traditionally treat technology. Mm. Like the most famous or one of the most famous books in user experience design is called Don't Make Me Think.
Mm.
Basically, users use technology on a total autopilot. Think of TikTok, you know, am I happy? Am I happy? Swipe. Am I happy? As soon as you're not happy, you swipe, you know, and that's kind of, you kind of like people, you know, famously just hit the button until the dialogues go away, right? So if it's warning them about something that might happen, they're not going to see that. And they're just going to say yes to, you know, all the terms. And what do I have to click to make this cookie banner go?
Yes, correct. I'll agree to anything. I'll sell my soul if you'll take away this banner.
Absolutely. Yeah, back in the day when you sold your soul, you got like really good at the guitar or something. Now you can just read the article. The wayward trade. So I'm kind of two minds here, where there's an aspect of, if you require a certain level of personal responsibility on behalf of the user, and we ran into this in Mutiny, you might have made a product that will never succeed, right?
Yeah. You're talking succeed at like scale.
Succeed at scale.
Yeah.
While at the same time, and so a lot of what OpenSecret is doing is basically providing a much more traditional user experience where you like log in with a, you know, username and password, but you actually get key management in the back end.
Okay.
But with the trade-off that we're trying to do as provably secure and safe as possible, and there's all this cryptography going on and attestation and stuff. But ultimately, there's a lot more trust involved than if you just could muster the time and discipline to figure out what's going on and write down your 12 or 24 words.
Do you offer like an option to do, like, is there like baby steps and then like advanced steps? Is that something that you either do or could do theoretically, or would that just be too much?
I think that's possible. And part of this is not just like every individual user's fault. There's also, I maybe it's my old age, but at this point, I'm tired of like signing up for things over and over. You know, like, you know, my Bitwarden has how many crazy logins?
100%.
So like, if my computer was designed around a private key, it would kind of make sense if there was basically, when you became an adult, like after a bit after or before, around the time you get your driver's license, you ended up with a private key for your money and a private key that was dissociated with your money.
Yeah.
And you kind of learned how to secure those, how to derive keys from those. And you'd go, and your device would understand that, and it would, you know, scan your face or use your fingerprint. When you unlock your device, now you can just interact seamlessly with every single service. I think that would be, a much better world. And so right now, you know, when you do all this work for a private key for like this one-off novelty wallet, you know, with a pirate theme, So it you can't quite blame everybody. So there's a lot of this that is kind of part of the whole stack. But yeah, anyways, right now for OpenSecret, mostly what we're doing is trying to replicate the traditional auth that people are used to, and then have that gives them access to a private key. Basically, it gives a developer that's making an application for this user to the power of having a private key tied to that user, and they, while also not having the ability to look at that user's data.
Okay. Unpack for me what, again, I know because we've talked about this, but just for listeners who are like, wait, why do you have a problem with self-sovereignty? What's your hang up with that, dude?
Well, it's, you know, God is sovereign.
Mm-hmm.
And there are, I don't know. I've been on a huge journey of this right now. I feel like, I'm a Presbyterian now. I feel like there's also been a whole journey of going from, like, you know, I grew up kind of just pretty traditional conservative to, I was calling myself an anarchist, to I'm probably, you know, pretty much a monarchist at this point. I think there's this really, I'm basically obsessed with the American Reformer podcast,
mm-hmm.
And the New Founding podcast, which is by the same people.
Shout out to Nate. Shout out to Josh.
The American Reformer podcast just had this guy on talking about, it was like a book written in the 1600s, kind of describing why society should be structured like this. And his argument, which is pretty compelling, is like, well, you know, God's king of the universe, right?
Yeah. Yep.
God's not sharing power. There's no checks and balances on God. You know, there's not a, here's how you impeach God when God goes wrong, you know? So like, there's this, I just read your piece on,
oh, yeah,
on taxes. You know, there is this aspect of the king in the here and now, the lowercase k king, the human, could be wrong, but that doesn't necessarily in all cases mean it's my place.
Yep, to do something about it.
Usurp.
Correct.
Him. And so anyways, I've been thinking a lot about that, but I just do not conceive of myself as sovereign. And I also find it odd, you know, we have this concept, at least like, I don't hear it very often, but I know I heard it a lot growing up, that in the U.S., the people are sovereign.
Mm. Yeah.
And the older I get, not even just philosophically or, you know, theologically, just like, that's just retarded. It's like, don't even the people are sovereign. It's like nothing else works like that in my life. Like the things that happen are because a person, an executive in some sense, takes charge and takes, I've got a buddy who I really like this term. He talks about in the design world, like when you're designing a product and there's a lot of stakeholders, there's developers, there's, you know, the people that have the money, there's the users, you know, ultimately to make like a good, interesting, important, great decision, there has to be a throat to choke. There has to be somebody whose fault it is. And I feel like a lot of the problem of modern politics, and, you know, at least in the U.S., is that it's nobody's fault. You know,
you've extrapolated away the fault. Yeah.
And if you can always shift blame to somebody else, it's this other person's fault. Then it's very easy to never fix anything.
Yeah.
And so by, you know, having, so I think that the nice thing about the self-sovereignty concept and a lot of the literature around that and what people actually do and build in that sense is it's about taking as much responsibility. It's not, you know, it doesn't always have to be usurping God or your local government.
Yeah.
It's about taking as much personal responsibility as you can and realizing, there's a developer I really like. It's like, you know, you sit down and you tell yourself, I am the reason everything's wrong with the world. And maybe you don't have to go that radical, but this idea that, you know, I could, the example I use a lot recently is, you know, Elon Musk chopstick thing obviously spoke to a lot of people, right?
Wait, what's this? I missed this.
When Elon Musk caught the rocket with the old robot arm, the chopsticks. And it was like one of those things where it's like, if Elon hadn't done that, but wanted to, I would have been happy to say, well, Elon can't get ahead because of all this regulation or this, all this lawfare or all these kinds of things, you know? But then he did do it. And so it's not like I would have been wrong to give him excuses if he had failed.
Yeah.
But then he did it anyways. And so I feel like a lot of times I give myself like kind of low expectations.
Yep.
Because there are so many excuses, but the people who actually do, the executives who actually execute and do great things, kind of take responsibility for the outcome. And try to work past, you know, whatever's, you know, holding them back.
Yeah, this resonates a lot with me. This is because like my thing is, I think about, I mean, again, I'm running Thank God for Bitcoin, and like there's so many things where I'm like, all right, I set out a plan. The plan seems like a good one. I start to execute the plan, and then the plan goes to crap. The plan just falls apart. You're like, why do I even plan? Like, what is the point? You know, it's sad. It just fails all the time. But like, that's, I mean, some of this is like, you have to take responsibility for what you know, for your energy, your time, all these kinds of things. You dedicate them and try to steward them in, you know, in a faithful way. And you're not always going to do that well. And so there, you know, there's things that you can learn from that. Yeah. I think I can resonate with sympathize with the struggling with the self-sovereignty. Again, I think it's like, stewarded sovereignty, I feel like would be, you know, a better way to put it or something. It's like God has given us sovereignty. Like God has given us time and resources and authority to wield under his ultimate authority. And I feel like, I think like historically that's looked a lot more involved than it does now. And it's because part of it is just, it's just because of ease. You know, it's easier to give away authority. It's more convenient. You know, I can give away in responsibility. Again,
what do you mean, keys. It's looked a lot more involved before. What do you mean?
So in the past, here's an example. So like in the past, you didn't have government bailouts, right? So like if you don't take care of your family, if you're not a good steward, then you're going to feel that, you know, you're going to feel those consequences much more directly and immediately than you would, you know, today. And so I think like we're just used to, and it's not a recent thing. I mean, it's not like an ancient thing. You're talking in the last 100 years, like not even 100 years, where we're just used to something happens. We go to the government and we expect them to help us, or just down to your bank account. I think about like your bank account, like right now, with our bank accounts, because we operate with fiat currency, if someone were to go to my bank account and clean it out, okay, I can go to my bank and basically say, hey, this person stole money from me. If they go through and verify that, yes, they indeed stole money from you, they'll put the money back in my account.
Right.
And, you know, it's
and there's something that, like, being insulated from consequences also somehow insulates you from the wisdom that those consequences or the threat of those consequences might develop in you.
Correct. And so, you look at, I mean, Ron Paul talked about this a lot. You know, you'd have, when he was running for president, he basically talked about the fact that, you know, like, what do you think we did in the 30s, you know, 40s or whatever, when people had trouble? Like, they would go to these, you know, and let's say they couldn't pay medical bills. Like, they would help write off the medical debt. Like, it wasn't just like, oh no, we didn't have government involved in healthcare, and so people just got, you know, left out in the street to die. Like, that's just not what happened. And so when you get the government involved in all these things, and when you give away some of your responsibility and you invite the government to take on more and more responsibility, then like you end up getting to the point where you're relying on them for everything. And they go to, you know, more horrifying and, you know, more and more horrifying ends to exercise that authority, whether it's here, whether it's around the world, or, you know, whatever it is. But yes, I do. I'm like sympathetic to, like, it's true that like we are not the captains of our own ship. And at the same time, like, God has, you know, God requires of us to be stewarded captains for this period of time and for those specific resources that he's put in front of us.
Right. We're not at the top of the hierarchy. Correct. We have responsibility.
Correct.
We're not slaves at the bottom of the hierarchy.
Correct. And this is, and so again, this is where the other reason I'm super sympathetic to this is because I talked about this at the conference, is like, we are in this period of definitional crisis, where we don't know what anything is, because our society, culture, like more broadly, like it's like gotten rid of any like submission to like there being a God. Like, functionally, our government is atheist, and like functionally it's humanist. They, you know, whatever the government wants to do is functionally okay. And so like even legally, like on paper, it's okay for them to do whatever they want to do. And so I think that you have a lot of people who are trying to come to grips with how to think about, you know, like, they know that's not true and they know that shouldn't be, but they also don't have like some sort of objective standard to appeal to help give definitional clarity. And so I think Christians, like, we obviously acknowledge that there's an authority, like, you know, an absolute authority that's outside of us. But the specific working out of that, I think we still struggle with, because of the, you know, because of the stream that we're swimming in and the people who are all around us. And so that's what motivated part of the, you know, that's what I wrote about in that piece about taxes. I wrote that for my Substack. If you guys are listening and haven't read that yet, you can go find it on my Twitter page. But it's just, yeah, about like what does it look like to think about taxes in the present moment, given, I mean, just what's going on. Like, there's lots of things that would basically demonstrate to us that the situation that we're finding ourselves in is not new by any stretch of imagination, but it's also not normal. And there's lots of awful things that are being done that we're just kind of going along with the flow with.
And I feel like there's something, I feel like maybe it's kind of silly. Just like 6 months ago, I felt like we were absolutely in the then they fight you phase. So like, you know,
this is Bitcoin or like, what is this? Is this everything?
Yeah. The samurai and was a big one. Tornado Cash, Wallet of Satoshi left the U.S. And you know, I'm in this wallet industry, also interested in privacy, and feels like they're coming after us. Like basically that the kind of the blobby they will never tolerate freedom to transact in, like, maybe the encrypted messaging kind of slipped by them and they're going to keep fighting that fight, but they're not winning right now, but they seem like they're winning with money, and we're kind of still in that, you know, that scenario. Like that is not completely solved. The Trump win helps Bitcoin in the kind of the larger, you know, financial institutional kind of way. It's not yet, you know, certain that we're going to see any help in the, I know Cynthia Lummis is trying to, you know, encode some like right to self custody and stuff like that, but it's not obvious yet that has, you know, sunk through into the administration, that they understand what kind of fight we're in here. But now, you know, that there are a lot of great wins, I think, for our team and for freedom generally. And there's obviously a very broad coalition that kind of signed up for this Trump thing.
Yeah.
And realizing that, people, our team maybe doesn't really know how to win, or not that they're doing anything wrong right now. It's just that I know for myself, like a lot of my identity has been around pointing out what's wrong with an existing system.
Yep.
And so it's like, you know, if you like, you imagine you're like bugging somebody on their driving for, you know, an hour and they finally just pull over.
You drive.
They hand me the keys. It's like, okay, I was great at identifying your flaws, but like, okay, am I actually? And I think there's a tension in the Christian feeling like, okay, well, God's in control.
Yeah.
I shouldn't. And I think there is a correct theology to not believe that the Christian themselves is responsible for saving the world.
Yep.
And yet. But the Christian has, I really like, David versus Goliath.
Mm-hmm.
He says that you come against me with sword and spear and javelin. Okay. Those are real physical things. Those are the threats. Those are my complaints. I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. So it doesn't say I come at you with slingshot, you know? You have sword and spear and javelin. I come at you with slingshot. No. I come at you in the name of the Lord, right?
Yep.
And the victory will be the Lord's. Yep. But also, David doesn't just sit there and pray the whole time and critique Goliath. Like,
correct.
He also does pick up a slingshot. And so I feel like the generation I've grown up in has kind of been not picking up slingshots very much.
Yeah.
And with the comfort in knowing that, like, we're correct in our critique of Goliath, or correct in our critique of the cowardly Israelites for not fighting Goliath, you know.
Yeah.
But the picking up slingshot, and I think that's what, you know, you're kind of getting into, at least in the phase of, you know, we're winning right now.
Yeah.
And we're also, you know, being carried a lot by a lot of people who are willing to just actually engage and do things. Not all of them are Christians. In fact, like the Republican coalition has gone much to the
left,
social left, because either the Christians failed to win themselves, the Christians failed to win by themselves, and had to add, you know, these doers to their ranks to get a win.
Yeah, and again, I think the people. I mean, you look at what Elon. I had some tweet about this. You look at what Elon risked Like, it is truly, like, and again, there was good reason. Like, he saw, I'm in an existential crisis right now. Like, if they win, they're going to attack me, and I'm going to be put out of business. I'm going to lose contract. Oh, he saw it very clearly. But it's, like, it's easy. It would have been easy to imagine someone getting paralyzed by that situation, right? And yet he just wasn't paralyzed and just totally gave all of his efforts. I mean, just every day. He's tweeting a couple hundred times a day. You know, just like retweeting anything to do with Trump, anything to do with people who are standing for, you know, standing up for free speech and all this kind of stuff. I do think this is so convicting because even though I just wrote this piece, the conclusion of which, spoiler alert, is basically like, hey, we might be at the time where we need to start thinking about like tax revolt, like honestly. And so like, even though like, but you may notice I didn't outline like a clear like plan to implement this kind of thing, or like, this is the point at which, you know, this is the point of no return. I did to a certain degree. I basically said like, if the government ever asked you to pay, you know, higher than like a 90% tax, you flatly say no, because, you know, on the basis of God gets 10%. And right. And then there's some other safeguards. But again, still, as I've been thinking, it's so ironic you say this, as I've been thinking about this for the last couple days, that was one of the things I was thinking was like, man, like, I'm not giving like a really, you know, hard defined path forward. Like, this is what this looks like. This is what you do. And part of that is just because I haven't thought that far completely. And at the same time, there's another part of me, which is like, well, I mean, this is going to sound, it could potentially sound like really extreme. And it's just like, I'm not doing this. I'm not thinking about this because I want to be super extreme. I'm just thinking about this because I really do think that we're at a point where, you know, it's an existential crisis, especially there's other countries where it's even more close to the point of no return. But yeah, I just think like I agree with you. We're not at the point where like we're good at, especially like, I think the Christian world, we're good at thinking, especially parts of the Christian world, like we're good at thinking, but we're not as good at arriving at a clear defined path of action that might result in people, you know, might result in the type of hostility that the apostles experienced.
You're right. The action, or yeah, even action plans that might not even result in hostility, I think have been a problem in my life. I was kind of this feeling, this is just my, you know, bitterness as a single. So please don't take this too seriously, but this idea that like, people were going to church. Yeah, I was in New York, you know, and church is filled with single people, but not a lot of them were getting married. And it's like, I felt like we were all learning how to identify flaws in each other. But we weren't really, you know, learning how to all get married and have babies.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Which was, you know, I feel like maybe could have been a higher priority.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, man. Yeah, it's just one of these things where, yeah, I just think that it's this difficult thing. And again, like when stuff, like one of the things I think about, again, just an example of this, this is more higher stakes. I've thought about this passage a lot in the last 10 months, has been the passage with Ananias and Sapphira, right? You know which one I'm talking about? It's like Acts 5, or I think it's Acts 5.
Oh, yeah.
Like this couple sells this property. There's other people who are selling properties, and then they give all of the money to the fledgling church. And so then there's this couple, they sell this property. They say that they're giving everything, but they really hold back a portion. And like basically the one, first of all, the guy walks in and Peter somehow knows, like the Holy Spirit communicates to him that he knows. And so he basically asks the guy, did you give us all the money? And the guy goes, yeah. And so then he basically says, your desire for riches will die with you. The guy drops dead and is carried out. His wife comes in a few minutes later. They ask her the same question. She doesn't know that her husband's dead. She basically says, yeah, we gave you everything. And then she drops dead too. And I'm just sitting there thinking like, can you imagine, like put yourself in the shoes. Imagine you're one of the other disciples, you know, it basically all we know that that Peter was in the room. We know that these two people were in the room, and then there might've been a couple other people, but imagine if you're just part of the broader church. Go ahead.
And he also explicitly says you didn't have to give everything.
Of course,
just the fact that you said,
it's the fact that you're lying about your generosity. So, but just imagine being one of the Christians outside and like, you know, you hear this commotion, they go out and they bring out this dead body and you know that they were in there with Peter and then Peter comes out and goes, yeah, God killed him. You know, you're just like, wait, God killed him or like God killed him through you? Or, and then like the authorities show up and they're like, there's these dead people. And Peter's like, yeah, that God killed him. And you're like, so you just think about like, there would have been such a, I mean, just like living in this situation, like it just would have been, there would have been the like so much room for miscommunication and for people to think, I mean, these Christians are murdering people. Like they're this cult that's murdering people for not giving them money. Like there's just all kinds of ways in which, you know, this, yeah, like there was so much room for confusion and yet God did it anyway. And like that's part of the thing that I just look around at us and this, the church today. I feel like we want to do everything to be winsome. We want to do everything to avoid offending and avoid even the appearance of evil or the appearance of rebellion or something like that. And the result is that we're just super nice.
Yeah.
We're super nice, but we're just like getting walked all over and our money's being taken to do God awful things with. There's just all kinds of things that's going on because we're, you know, afraid to kind of just speak up and be vocal and stuff.
Do you know Joe Rigney?
Yeah. Yep.
He was on the New Founding podcast and he was talking about this. I think this is what his new book is about. So something about emotions and leadership or something like that.
Yeah. Emotional sabotage or something like that.
Yeah. But his basically, he kind of is doing a breakdown of, so Paul goes to rebuke Peter because like the Judaizers have like corrupted, like Peter is siding with the Judaizers.
Yeah.
So Paul is telling Peter that he's wrong. And the way Joe Rigney breaks this, obviously he does this a lot better than me because he's actually studied it, but it's basically there's bad people, right?
Yeah.
Then there's like weak people who go with what the bad people want.
Yep.
And then there's like Peter who is, yeah, probably he's kind of probably being nice.
Yeah.
And, or, you know, other, you know, motivations or fear, you know, Peter famously is, you know, also susceptible to peer pressure from like a random slave.
Yeah, exactly.
Like basically anybody could peer pressure Peter in certain scenarios, apparently.
Yep.
And Paul mentions also, you even got Barnabas, like, so like, even like my A tier of this club fell for this too, probably because, you know, maybe Barnabas is looking at Peter, like, well, look, Peter's going to go.
He's like, you're the apostle. You're, you know, I trust you like that. Right. Yeah.
And so I think it's such a great breakdown of this, how it kind of that stair stepping, or I don't know what you call it, but like that starts out as just an obviously bad idea and somehow ends up as policy at a church.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because everybody's being nice somehow. And the interesting thing about that, that's not merely a call for a masculine energy to be highly disagreeable and be, a toxic maximalist. Sometimes it is a call for that, but it's also a call for having, you know, you mentioned in your piece, you know, wisdom, like it's reading the scriptures, pouring over. We want to be able to be confidently and aggressively say no to evil. And so we have to, you know, we have to know the difference. So we actually, you know, there's a call to both be firm and also be, you know, wise and knowledgeable. So there's like a digging in aspect of this too. It's not just being disagreeable.
Yeah. Yeah. There's not value in just being disagreeable. And the fact that you're disagreeable means you're being brave. Like that's not necessarily the same thing. This actually reminds me, did you see the picture of Trump and Trump Jr. and somebody else, Elon and RFK Jr. either eating McDonald's on the plane? Did you see that picture?
Yeah.
And so somebody shared that picture and they said, like they zoomed in on RFK Jr. and they said, Peter, when he was eating with the Judaizers, he's got the McDonald's in front. It's so good.
This is a total tangent, but I'm trying to dream this into the world. I want there to be a reality show where RFK Junior basically puts J.D. Vance through hell because J.D. Vance is kind of face fat. And so the way that RFK will communicate to the nation about how to live and eat healthy is by making J.D. Vance suffer for his sins.
So, wait a second. JD and not Trump. I'm confused.
No, Trump is just sitting there pretty, eating McDonald's in the background, laughing at whatever, you know. JD Vance is doing push-ups and Trump is eating a french fry. I just think it would be really entertaining. Because Trump's already won. But if JD Vance wants to, you know, carry on this legacy, if he's to run for president, he's got to trim down the face fat.
That's so.
And yeah, so anyways, I really want this to exist.
Did you hear it was Dana White? Dana White of the UFC was sitting there. He was talking about Trump and he said, I have never seen Trump drink water. He's like, I've hung out with him a lot and I've never seen him drink water. He only drinks Diet Coke. And so, yeah, I feel like
amazing. It sounds like the one thing that Trump does that would sound correct to me is that he is basically intermittent. He's kind of omit. Yeah, he's kind of an intermittent fat. Everything else he's doing absolutely wrong. And, you know, good for him to have those kind of genes. Well, the rest of us have to take RFK's advice.
We're in the struggle.
This episode is also brought to you by our good friends at CrowdHealth. CrowdHealth is here to provide you with a new way to pay for your healthcare. It's not health insurance, which is expensive, increasingly complicated, and impersonal. And CrowdHealth is working to change that model. You pay them a monthly fee, and that fee accumulates in an account that you control and can be held in dollars or in Bitcoin. Then if you have a health event, CrowdHealth goes to the doctor on your behalf and they negotiate the price lower for you, allowing you to save anywhere from 20 to 80% on your bill. You pay the first $500 out of pocket and then the CrowdHealth community covers the rest. They have Bitcoin Lightning payments that they've enabled. So if you want to pay your monthly fee or even your doctor in Bitcoin via Lightning, you can do that now. They've got a growing roster of doctors that are beating down their door to work with them. Their CEO is a friend and a Christian, and they're approaching healthcare in the right way. It's a healthy community that focuses on preventative healthcare and avoids big pharma as much as possible. My family and I use CrowdHealth instead of insurance and couldn't be happier with that decision. So if you're not happy with your health insurance and are looking for a more sane human healthcare alternative, go to joincrowdhealth.com and use promo code TGFB at checkout to get 30% off your first 3 months. That's joincrowdhealth.com using promo code TGFB at checkout. Now back to the show.
Okay, so beyond this, what else is going on? What else have you been thinking about?
I'm reading that Christian nationalism book.
Really?
Stephen Wolf. Did you watch the Bukele interview with Tucker Carlson?
I don't think I did. I might have seen clips, but I didn't watch the whole thing.
There's a little moment that has almost become like the whole definition of my politics. It's like, Tucker's asking, how did they clean up this gang problem? And Bukele is walking through kind of like what their plan was. And it's like, okay, so we got this whole plan together and we started it and it didn't work. So we stopped and we prayed about it. And then the interview does not go on to explain like what they changed strategy wise, but there's just this really, and it didn't sound trite, and Tucker like really emphasizes this point, you know. Tucker way. And it just, I again, like, that who is sovereign?
Yeah.
The biggest deal is that we believe and act that God is sovereign.
Yeah.
An example I really like is I always get them wrong. I should probably look this up. But you know when they're trying to get water out of the rock? Moses is trying to get water out of the rock.
Yep.
And he speaks to God says, speak to the rock and the water will come out. And the water comes down. Everybody's happy. The next time he wants water, he goes and like hits the rock.
Yeah. First time he was supposed to hit it. The second time he was supposed to speak to it. And instead of speaking to it, he hit it.
Oh, okay, so he was supposed to hit it the first time. Yeah, so it was just like, five times I read that in the Bible, I was just like, God, why do you have to be so particular. That means, you know, I feel like he generally is following your will here, but it's this illustration of like God will not be usurped for who gets the credit.
Yep.
And that might, for us, that kind of sounds like egotistical or something like that, but it just seems the constant refrain. You know, our pastor right now is going through the book of Judges. And so it's just new leader over and over, the Spirit of God overcomes them, and they only succeed insofar as God wants them to succeed. And like, you know, Gideon raises up a small army and God's like, that's too many. I'm not going to get the credit, you know?
Yeah.
So anyways, just for Bukele to credit God in that interview, I thought was really beautiful. And I really feel like I've been very obsessive, like kind of the libertarian way, or even kind of conservatism, like you wanting small government, being a constitutional conservative, obsessing over the systems is kind of like a bureaucratic. I think Elon, like, or somebody on Twitter just tweeted like a Thomas Sowell quote about this. This is like the essence of bureaucracy, is to obsess over the systems rather than the outcomes.
Yep.
And so I think the Christian, because our outcome is already fixed, we can credit that outcome to God. And we theoretically should be better at risking it than anybody else. Because what are we risking? You know?
Yep.
In Acts, when the Sadducees arrest the apostles for preaching, one of the Pharisees says, maybe we shouldn't do this. He says, keep away from these men and let them alone, for if this plan or this undertaking is of man, it will fail. But if it is of God, you will not be able to overthrow them. You might even be found opposing God. So I feel like if we are confident in what is right, we can just have this incredible confidence in how we act. And if we decide that we want to do things ourselves or take credit for ourselves, we can have an incredible confidence that we will ultimately be thwarted. And so I think there's something about that that's kind of simplified politics a little bit for me, rather than kind of like, what structure, you know, checks and balances, things like that. It's like, hey, is there a good person who is going to give credit to God? Or is there something else going on?
Yeah, no, I do. I think that's a really, again, I think a lot of Americans, we would look down on a monarchy. Like, by virtue, we look at this is some antiquated thing. And yet, like, if you think about this for 10 minutes, you're like, again, obviously monarchy can go bad. Like, no one debates this, but like, okay, but look at our republic. Our republic's gone pretty bad. And so it's like, I feel like the thing that I've said to people is like, so democracy has a higher floor, maybe. Like, it's got a higher floor, but it's also got a lower ceiling. Whereas like monarchy has like, it can have a super low floor, but the ceiling, like if you have one guy who's got ultimate power and he's a good guy, like it's incredible what you can get done. And like you're seeing now, again, Bukele is not a king, but just like, again, there comes a point where things get so bad that, I mean, like the law becomes something that enslaves and prevents good from happening rather than something that facilitates good. And this is, you saw this in Jesus' time. You saw like this is something the Pharisees, again, they were so focused on the minutia of the law that they missed the big picture. You know, I talked about this in the piece, like they lost sight of what is the big picture here? Like, what is the point of these, you know, the point of these laws? Like, this actually reminds me, there was just this article where somebody tweeted about somebody in North Carolina, I think, gave like 200 tiny homes. There may have been 20, something. They bought like a whole bunch of tiny homes for people who had their homes destroyed. And some government entity showed up looked at these things and said, no, they're not gonna be able to withstand, they're not rated for this or whatever, according to our laws and our building codes or something like that, and basically made them take them away. Yeah. And it's just like, I literally shared I retweeted and put the verse of woe you hypocrites, like you won't enter into the kingdom and you keep others from going in as well. And it's like, obviously this isn't the kingdom, but like you have these people who are genuinely doing something that is great. It's a great thing to do, very thoughtful, would actually be helpful. And yet because it doesn't keep the letter of the law in this case, you're literally turning people away, putting people in worse situations. And so, yeah, I just think that it just confirms what we're kind of talking about. Is like we're getting to this point where we've so lost sight of a standard by which to measure the goodness or badness of what we're doing that now it's just all about opinions. And like we really need some adults and grownups to really just basically grownups both at a, well, we need grownups at a smaller local level, like just people who are willing to take ownership and take authority, like basically just ownership over something and just basically I'm going to do something about this. But then we also need that as you escalate up the ranks in government or businesses or whatever it is. But yeah, I just still think it's one of these things where there could easily be a cost to it, right? So like if you're an organization, whatever, this tiny home organization, let's say they say this is ridiculous. Like what you're telling us we can't do this is ridiculous. We're going to do it anyhow. Okay. We're going to give them out anyhow. And we're going to keep doing what we're doing. Like in the short term, like they could jail you, they could fine you, they could do whatever. And yet like you get to the point where, I mean, the question is like, how do you know what's right? And what are you ultimately willing to do? Are you willing to suffer to do what's right? And I think that we're kind of at that point where people are, you know, being more and more willing to do that, but it's definitely not easy. And tough to figure out what to do.
One of my big things, I feel like the first step, I would like to break this down a little bit because I think that's really invaluable. If we could figure out, you know, this would be a good unlock for us, I'm sure. My first step, and this has kind of become a bit of my life first, is turn from your rage. I think it's a Psalm 37, and it's not all the translations translate like that. But it's basically this idea of like, if you are, there's a kind of rage at injustice that actually like turns into impotence. I think it's almost, rage can almost be like, as porn is to marriage, rage is to injustice. It's like this thing that gives you a feeling like you're kind of doing something about this thing that really matters. Because the injustice is itself very bad and it is worth being fought against, but this rage that leads to kind of this, you know, a lack of action because you kind of burn yourself out in some sense, or you kind of build up a fear, or I think also kind of what comes across in Psalm 37 is this idea of envy. It's like I could have all these nice things. I think a good one with a Bitcoiner, it's like, you know, I had a bunch of opportunities to join various Telegram rooms over the past few years, and I could have, you know, a nice pump and dump to my name, but I'm so moral, right?
Yeah.
I'm so good. And what you're doing is you're kind of, when you're jealous of the receipts of evil, you actually end up kind of starting to be jealous of evil.
Yep.
So anyways, that's my step one. And then I guess the ... profit is, well, you know, at the end, like they're bad, like the guy who says don't, you know, you can't have these houses here, right? Or the real famous one right now is whichever idiot told the Amish to stop doing raw milk, right? And lost the state of Pennsylvania.
Correct. Yes.
I don't know how perfectly true that story is, but I love it. I'm just gonna stick with it because that's like, you know, that they're bows turn on themselves kind of thing, you know? So there, I think there's this really exciting thing with the government right now where it's so ridiculously wasteful.
Yeah.
That if Vivek and Elon just like accidentally trip and smash the keyboard and fire somebody, it only good things will happen. Yes. By being so awful, But anyways, I don't quite know all the steps in the middle. But I'm very bullish long term, and I feel like my first step a lot of times is to kind of turn from my rage.
Mm. Yeah, no, I think that definitely seems like great advice to me, and it's convicting because again, I've done that. Like again, and that's kind of Twitter, like being on Twitter can just foster the rage or foster like the, again, like the fake triumphalism too, because you can be excited. You can be excited about this victory that was won. That's like, I mean, again, it's like cool, but at the same time, you're I don't know. It's just, it's so easy to get sucked into like the global or like the national stuff and feel like because you're contributing in some capacity at that level, that somehow is a bigger win than getting involved with like local politics or your family or something like
right.
that. Or,
right. A sensation I've had recently is like, okay, I'm so triumphant about this win. Well, what did I do to cause it? Ignore every single text. For some reason, I get texts that are for my mom to support Trump, you know? So just ignore every single text asking for money. I didn't put up a sign. I live in like a pretty liberal neighborhood, you know? Like, I didn't drive a friend to the polls, you know? Like, so like, I'm celebrating because, quote unquote, we won.
Yeah.
This always bothers me when like science educators talk about we discovered the general theory of relativity. It's like, oh, you did it. So if I reverse engineer, okay, well, I do like this outcome.
Yeah.
Who was partially responsible for it and how did they get involved? What did they sacrifice, you know? And so like maybe there's something like that in my future where I can identify a good that I want that is speculative and then, you know, lean in and sacrifice towards that outcome.
Yeah, man. Oh, this is crazy you bring that up. So I was, my wife had like a book club last night and I was home with the kids, cleaned up the house, you know, did all the stuff. And we weren't supposed to watch a movie, but I had a headache and I was like, all right, we're just going to put on a movie. So I was like trying to find something remotely defensible and found this movie called One Life. And it's about this guy, Nicky something, who basically helped like 669 orphans or children escape different countries in Europe. I think most of them were like Czechoslovakian, but escape countries in Europe before the Nazis came through there. And like this dude, he was like a banker. He had like a super comfortable job. And like in his free time, he was like going out to find, you know, like basically communicating with people who were actually there and just trying to figure out ways to get these kids, like find as many kids as possible and then bring them to the UK before, you know, they were killed or their, you know, parents were killed, all this kind of stuff. And this guy is played by Anthony Hopkins.
Hmm.
Just a great movie. But this guy just basically, I mean, he just feels like he takes so much ownership that he feels like so personally responsible for all of these kids. He just saw so clearly, like, if I don't work to get them out of there, like they're not going to get out of there. And so he's sitting there and he's working. And then like one of the last trains that was supposed to come had like 250 kids on it. It would have been 250 more. They basically, right as it was about to leave, they pulled everybody off the train and they ended up not making it. And so it's just this horrible thing. And like they get to this one point where, when that happened, he came home, his wife wasn't home. He went out into the backyard. She found him later in the backyard. He's like balled up in this chair, just bawling his eyes out. He's just like this guy who's just bawling his eyes out over the fact that, you know, like just thinking about how many more people he could have saved, he could have rescued. And he just took like radical ownership. And then even once the war was over, he wasn't some celebrity because he didn't tell anybody about it. He didn't want anybody to know about what he'd done. And so it wasn't until like 50 years later that you can find this clip. It's amazing.
I've seen this clip where he's like seated in this audience of people and a person turns to him like, you saved me. And then another person says, you saved me, everybody. Everybody, the whole audience had been saved by this guy.
So yeah, so it's just, this kind of, it just goes right in line with what we're saying, right? It's just like, I mean, this guy, he wasn't looking for, you know, earthly fame. He just was, he saw people in need and just said to himself, okay, like I can do something about this.
Right.
And so like, there's like all kinds of, you know, dubious things. He was annoying. He had to be annoying to these government officials to get them to help him because they, you know, they basically, it would have been easier to not do anything. it would have, you know, brought a lot less, you know, potential for all kind of potential things that could have got them in trouble. Again, like if one of these kids gets lost or something, then they get blamed for it. You know, they're trying to help, but it doesn't.
Right. This is at risk of trivializing your absolutely wonderful example.
Go for it.
Just thought of the, you know, UX, like this idea, like what good things in our life come from taking the path of least resistance.
Yeah.
Like there are some,
yeah,
but very few. And like the things that are, you know, like is loving and supporting your kids the path of least resistance for you? You know, is being in shape and eating well, is that the path of least resistance? Any long-term relationship, family, most of the things that we find very important are not going to this. And so I think there's something really exciting. I'm almost thinking about this, you know, in the technology terms. I want to think about it in broader terms too, this idea of, you know, I'd like to make technology for people who are trying to do more rather than people who are trying to get by through life with their brain off.
Yeah.
You know, and I think there is maybe a bit of like a, yeah, a theology of what I'm building. And also, you know, like, there's something about, I'll always forget the new founding guy. He spoke at Thank God for Bitcoin.
Nate.
Yeah. Nate was talking about, you know, we are, kind of lacking a positive vision right now. So like, what is the thing that you identify? This guy identified a problem and was willing to go after it. You know, I think a lot of people don't really think there is anything for them that like matters that much. And so, you know, maybe as a Christian, you're really focused on your personal holiness and that's great. But is there something that is big and inspiring, that you would, crawl through glass for?
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, I do. Yeah. And again, a lot of this comes back to, I think, like money and Bitcoin. I think a lot, because again, one of the things is, the less money that you have and the less money that, I mean, like sections of society have, the more, again, at least in some degree, like the less bandwidth you have to be able to think about stuff like this. And so like, I mean, one of the examples was like in, you know, like, so when we were in Uruguay, basically you'd have a lot of the kids, they would go to school. Like if you were wealthier, you would very likely send your kid to a private school. And the way that the private schools work is that you go in at 7 a.m. They're there till like 4. Then usually in order to afford to be able to send your kids to private school, both mom and dad are working. So the kids get off school at 4, then they'll go to it's called a club, but like basically it's like an after school, you know, place. It's like a gym where they have all kinds of games. And so the kids will go there and they'll play. They'll be there with their friends. They'll do homework and they might not get home till like 7. So they get home at 7. That's when they're seeing mom and dad for the first time since 7 a.m. They're exhausted. They come home, they hang out for a little bit, they eat, and then they go to bed and then they do it all over again. And so it's like now in those cases, that's not a lack of resources. It's a prioritization problem. It's like, what do you value? That's determining it. But you have other people who like, they might want to do that. They might want to send their kids, but they still have to work, you know, out of jobs. And so they don't have in order to provide for their family, it gets tighter and tighter for them to be able to do that. And so like, it just gets tougher. They don't have maybe the same time that they would normally have or wish that they could have with their kids. And so I think like that's at least part of what I think about with Bitcoin is like a lot of these organizations, there's so much more that they could do. And it's only going to get worse as time goes on. They're going to have less money. They're going to be able to do less things. And so I think
what organizations are you talking about?
So like missions organizations. So money is just, it's one element of this that does have it has a lot of repercussions. But I just think that type of thing, so not only does that limit parents' ability to spend time with their kids, but it also basically affects parents' ability and like neighbors' ability to get to know each other and spend time together and all that kind of stuff. And so it's like death by a million cuts. It just kind of erodes a lot of the time. And then as a result of you're not spending as much time, it erodes the relationship and the trust that is built through spending time together. I think a lot of this stuff, again, that's like a couple examples, but then you have other examples where they just kind of compound on each other and it just breaks down the trust that exists. And then you have more and more reliance on governments rather than relying on each other the way that, you know, you would for most of human history. You had to rely on each other. You had to be a good neighbor. Like, there was a lot more incentive to be a good neighbor because your well-being was much more closely tied to, you know, to your neighbors being able to help you when you had needs than we are today. We can make up for that lack of neighbors or lack of family with money. So you can do that and see that in the case of like retirement homes or stuff like that. You know, like we're gonna like normally the currency that we'd be denominating our relationships in would be love. And in lieu of that, we're going to use money now to kind of make up for. So our kids aren't going to take care of us. We're going to pay these strangers to take care of us. In order to motivate them to do so, we're going to need to pay them a lot more than we would pay, you know, our families to do it.
The thing that always bothers me, I don't know the exact math of it, but it always bothers me when the wife works to make enough money for daycare because she's working.
I know. And again, a lot of people like it's frustrating, right? Because like that does happen. Like they're making just enough to pay for daycare. And you're like, well, then what are we doing here? You know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I always struggle to quite delineate what is. Yeah. There's the type of money and then there's how much money you have. So obviously lots of people have enough money.
Yeah. Yep.
That, you know, so it doesn't seem like it's totally a money problem.
Yeah.
That they are putting their kids in care or that there's no trust. At the same time, there are people who are actually in that desperation that don't have that. You know, you mentioned that guy that saved those kids as a banker. Like people, you know, if you're literally living hand to mouth, you don't have time to like go to the government office. You know, you have this hobby of saving people. But at the same time, I do know that there is an aspect of when you are desperate money wise, when you hit kind of rock bottom, it is a lot easier to trust God. And I always struggle with that. Anytime that I have achieved any level of stability and comfort for myself, career wise or financial wise, it's very easy to. Well, I'm good. Thanks, dog. You could drop me off here. And it's such a natural, continual repeat. I think that's helpful. I really enjoyed this series in Judges and just kind of the whole Old Testament, this repeated thing. It's not like you learn the lesson one time that you're supposed to trust God. You learn the lesson, you trust God, God comes through, and then you forget the lesson, and then, bad things happen.
Yeah. And again, like that, like, man, yeah. Just thinking about it, it gets to kind of the thing. It gets at what is God looking for? Like, what does God want from us? And he doesn't desire us to just get to this end state where we have the right things, you know, or we make the right decisions. He wants to be with us and he wants us to trust him. Like that's the whole point of choosing, you know, his choice to create a world that operates faith by faith and that needs faith in order to please him is, you know, he's seeking us for us to trust him, right? That's what he's after. And that trust comes through dependence, and dependence means not being the captains of our own ship and having everything together. You know, our weakness is something that again is a gift from him to get us to trust him and ask for his help.
And I think something that's been helpful for me is trying to kind of realize that God's plan for the world is not I don't want to say this in a way that I'll get me kicked out of my church, but like that it's beyond spirit. You know, God, the original directive to fill the earth and subdue it has not gone away. And that while we are saved to be able to enjoy God and love God, that is an aspect of his calling for us on earth. And that really to serve God and love God and enjoy God is to follow his rules and mandates. And
yeah.
One of his mandates is fill the earth and subdue it. And that might include the stars. Like, you know, I bet that like there's, we know, it would take about, like 80 something doublings of humanity to like have a human per star, as far as
yeah.
stars we know of. It's like 2 to the 80th something. And then the travel time, if there's no, you know, but maybe there, you know, maybe faster than life travel is possible. I think I have a sense that we're probably supposed to domesticate all animals. Like, I think we're like selling ourselves short by just having a few. I was learning recently, like plants, you know, when they're they're domesticated, they can like switch back to like a wild form and stuff like that. So maybe we're supposed to domesticate all plants.
Can we just talk about the fact that plants have genders? Am I just like the only moron who didn't know that? I did not know this, but yes.
Is it like a guy tree and a girl tree?
Correct. I did not know this, but like it's, we went and visited Patrick Henry's house in Virginia. Give me liberty or give me death, that Patrick Henry. And there's these orange trees. They're like these giant, gross looking oranges. They're all kind of like knotted and weird looking, but like only the female trees produce the oranges. Like the male tree, like they need to like come together in order to produce like the actual fruit. It's like super weird.
It's like a chickens and a rooster situation. There's like one male orange tree.
100%. And so I'm like, how did I not know that trees were gendered? Like I've heard the same thing. Hey, I've heard the same thing about like avocados. It's the same similar thing there. I just didn't know this. I'm just confused.
Well, and I think this is one of those things. This is what's so wonderful about God's creation. We were talking about, you know, that possibly monarchy kind of better typifies God's general structure of existence. And so, you know, a lot of things that we do are kind of some sort of, you know, that like taking communion, you know, symbolizes Christ's, you know, death and resurrection, his sacrifice for us. So like there are other things in nature. I mean, I think that's one thing that's been so much fun about AI is this exploration into like what is the kind of mechanical non-soul part of thought. So we're delving into these, you know, just very marvelous, very interesting things, and they're reflected across all of creation in all these different ways. And so everything we learn, anything we learn about any part of creation is kind of a way of learning about all of creation. There's so much more fun stuff to unlock and learn about. And I'm very bullish on that.
I agree. I will push back on you as relates to exploring the stars. I've gone on record that I believe space travel is satanic. I believe the desire, because again, you actually outlined why, right? So you said like, what is the command? Be fruitful, multiply, and subdue the earth. Okay. So again, one of the temptations that humans always face throughout the scriptures and throughout history is to set aside the thing that God has given us to do in order to do another cool thing, right? And so I look
at
So I look at space travel and I'm like, all right, so there's billions of people down here who are living in poverty, who are, you know, experiencing all these things. And again, God bless Elon, like incredible ingenuity. Like it's unreal how smart this guy is and how much he gets done. If Elon, like if he like read the scriptures and was like, this is what God has given me to do, you're telling me that Elon couldn't better serve humanity by using his ingenuity to just straight up go out and just like solve world hunger or figure out some way to, you know, to tame animals or whatever. Like, but instead he's taking all of these resources, including in the form of government subsidies, and like pushing like how to colonize another planet, when like God has a plan for this planet, as far as you know, like this, you know, he's going to bring a new heavens, new earth, everything. And yet rather than, you know, because Elon doesn't believe that, he's taking these resources from Earth and trying to use them to escape Earth because of this vision that he has of the eschaton, which is the Earth is going to burn up and blow up. And so we need to escape from it. And so as a Christian, I look at that and I'm like, I'm sorry, Elon, I do not share your eschatology. And so I think that there's lots of earthly uses for these resources that would, you know, people would be a lot better served if they were being used here. So. I'm willing to be pushed back on, but
make a strong argument. I mean, I don't think the idea that there are some, you know, like there's some hungry people in England. So why are you leaving England, you know, or something like that and going to a different place? There's also theoretically resources out there.
Correct.
Help us here.
Correct. For example, satellites. Great. Like we're able to, but again, like you can look at satellite. A Christian could easily have created satellites, right? You're like, all right, we like these things will allow us to get the gospel to people who are, you know, far away. So like that. So like
okay.
The technology.
So you're, Yaza, you're allowed to put your toe into space.
Correct. Yeah.
You can't. You're not allowed to go. What about the moon?
So what's the purpose of it? What's the goal?
The moon satanic?
No. What's the goal? What's the goal of going to the moon?
So cool.
Now, granted. I guess here's the thing. So who's paying for us to go to the moon? This is the other thing. A lot of this comes down to the money, right?
I agree on that front. The government should not be paying for or subsidizing space experts.
So if you're going to use private funds, somebody who like has worked hard and the product of that labor, they want to do that with it. Like I still don't agree with it, but at least that's not created through the issuance of debt that then our children and grandchildren are going to have to pay back. That's a different level of wrong.
I can absolutely agree with you on that. Yeah, it's tough. I mean, there are parts of me that have thought that. It's like, you know, it does say Earth, right? So it's like, Maybe all the stars is like our level two mission. Like we go to heaven, and then we are with God, and God's like, all right.
This is the garden, right?
Oh, this is why I'm on this podcast announcing that I am a Mormon.
But like this is honestly, if you go back to you look at the pattern, like again, it's not that Adam and Eve were never supposed to eat the fruit of the garden. It's that they were supposed to wait until the right time. And then like that would have been part of their, you know, becoming kings, like they're, you know, kings and queens. Like basically, like that would have been, God wanted them to eat this fruit in a certain time, but they took it too soon. And so this is the same thing that we fall into, like premarital sex. It's not that sex is wrong. It's that taking it outside of its proper context and timing is wrong. And so over and over again, so much of what denominates something as being wrong or sinful is taking it out of its time. It's not necessarily that you wanted something wrong. It's that you did it in the wrong time. And so I look at space travel and I'm like, listen, I'm all for going to space, like in God's timing, when there's not, you know, when we don't have, Great Commission urgency, you know, like when they're so like that's great, we can do that, but it just doesn't seem to me like the right timing. I agree it's cool, I agree, you know, all these right. Cool things,
and we don't have the fire under our butts. Elon fearing the end of the world, like we right. We are not fearing all the nuclear apocalypse. It does feel like they're the blob is really trying. They're really hoping for, which that's so bizarre to me.
Well, and just to acknowledge, I mean, the other thing to acknowledge there is, I mean, we could have nuclear apocalypse in the United States. Like there's nothing prohibiting that from happening or other, I mean, it's already happened in Japan, all these kind of things. It's just like, we just don't see like the whole world isn't going to blow like that. That we're not afraid of that to the same degree.
Right.
But yeah. So again, that's a side note. I went on somebody else's podcast and they brought up Elon and they were talking about Tesla and they were super excited about it. And I was like, sorry guys, but
what a downer. Or long enough to find with somebody to do it. You're wrong.
Do it.
Go for it. So muy reasoning.
Yeah, I'm willing to for the glory of God. I'm willing to be wrong.
There you go.
Oh man. Well, cool. We've been going for about an hour and 18 minutes. Is there anything else on your mind, Paul? This is what I want to do this periodically, because you, again, you're one of the most thoughtful people I've ever met, and I love talking to you. Anything else that's just an itch you want to scratch right now?
No, I think we covered it.
Got it.
We're good. I got the domesticate all animals thing. I love it. Okay. So yeah.
All right, Paul, here's a question then to close. If you could domesticate and have any animal as a pet, what would it be?
I mean, I know they've already been domesticated, but I really like the idea of like using a elephant as some sort of like as a tractor, basically.
Let's go. Love it. I was literally, this is so funny we're having this conversation now, because the other way,
a dinosaur. But I could ride.
That'd be sweet. But I was just thinking this the other day. So we were looking at a house that's got like, it's probably got, we were looking at the house that has some acreage. And so I was thinking about having more acres, and I was like, man, it'd be cool to have some sort of like semi-exotic pet, like nothing, you know, nothing huge or crazy. So I started looking into like, again, smaller cats. I was like looking into like a lynx. You can get a lynx for like, I think, or no, bobcat. You can get a bobcat for like $900.
Wow.
I was like, I would love to have a bobcat. Just, you know, like maybe, you know, defang it or whatever and just like have it around the house, get it as a baby and then just like raise it up. I'm not a big cat person, but having like a bigger cat would be just, I think it'd just be super cool.
Just loves you to pieces.
Yeah. It'd be great.
That's great.
So that's mine. Cool. I think it'd
Are
be
you gonna
about
do it?
I'm thinking about it. Like I'm, again, there was one other one. The other one I've said all the time is a skunk, because you can get, apparently you can get this, the scent, the stink gland or whatever, you can get it removed. And then it's just like a cat. It's like a little bit bigger cat, but apparently they make really good pets.
All right. See, well, you're already further down this road than I am. Well, there we go.
We'll see if this happens. We didn't buy the house, so we'll see. But,
well, I love talking to you. I also, if people haven't heard it, that, we didn't get a chance to talk about this, but it's the McLuhan stuff that talked to the grandson.
Yep.
That checklist, it's funny because I can't even remember the whole checklist.
Me either.
I've written it down, but that checklist of what it, you know, what does this technology replace? What happens when it's like abused? You know, I feel like that is such a healthier way to think about technology rather than having a binary technology good, technology bad. So I've been very much enjoying kind of examining technology through that half-remembered lens that I heard on that podcast.
Go listen to that. That's an episode of the Thank God for Nostra podcast. Go listen to that. We interviewed Marshall McLuhan, Canadian, basically like technology ethicist. We interviewed his grandson, Andrew, and he just kind of gave his grandfather's checklist for how to evaluate technology. I think it was like 5 steps, if I'm not mistaken. But just brilliant, super helpful. One of these things that's just super encouraging where you're like, man, we're not the first ones to navigate these things. There's been people doing it for decades, in obviously in different degrees, hundreds of years. Go listen to that. And again, we are grateful for Paul's time. This will not be the last time. We'll probably have him on sometime within the next 3 or 4 months. I'll give you the last word, Paul.
Oh, man. My old catchphrase used to be Paul. I would just say Paul.
Paul out.
Paul. So that's the wisdom that you've come to know and learn.
Well, cool. Well, thank you, Paul. We love you.
Christ be with you.
Amen. Again, we are thankful for, let's see, Farmer Bills. Go check out them. Use promo code TGFB at checkout. We are thankful for river.com. Go buy your Bitcoin over there. Use promo code TGFB at checkout. And go check out Crowd Health. Paul, do you work with Crowd Health? I'm trying to get you to dox your health information right now.
I am, as a former smoker, I'm not allowed to use, but I work in the same co-working space as Andy, so I just give him crap all the time for deplatforming me. And
wait, you're a former smoker, so you can't even as a former smoker?
I read the fine print, maybe they've changed it, but that was the case. The product I want, Crowd Health is awesome, and if you can get it, I say go for it, but their ability to help you find a doctor who's kind of ideologically aligned and that will accept cash. Like I've been begging them for that forever. And so anyways, hi, Andy. Thanks for sponsoring this podcast. Please solve all of my problems. And I'm sorry.
There's got to be like a statute of smoking limitations. Like there's got to be a certain period after which you requalify. We need to get Andy back on the podcast. We'll confirm that. But yeah, use promo code TGFB to check out there. You can go check out and see if it's right for you. But if you're a younger person, younger family, like it's a great option to help you pay less for your health insurance. It's a health insurance replacement. Go check them out. Again, love you, brother. Appreciate you. And we will chat with you on the next episode of the TGFB podcast.
Sweet.